Let's start where we left off last Sunday, with the story of turning water into wine. I said that on one level, that story is about a movement from a focus toward on outward righteousness and ritual cleansing to a focus on inner transformation. It's a story about moving from the ritual of symbolic water cleansing to the inner intoxication of love expressed through community. That love is like the alcohol in wine that changes us on the inside when we let it in. The Gospel of John frames the movement as a movement from Judaism to Christianity, but that's not really fair. Jews can have a focus on inner transformation, and there's plenty of Christians who have a focus on outward moral purity. But for John, in his context, writing in 90 CE, he was contrasting his experience of Judaism with his experience of the Christian community. So that was one level of turning water into wine. On another level, I said the story was about a scarcity mindset versus an abundance mindset. It was about moving from a belief that we don't have enough and we'll never have enough, and therefore we need to hoard resources, to the belief that we'll always have enough if we share with everyone. And in fact, we'll have more than enough when we do that. So in a very similar way, we can say that this morning's story of the cleansing of the temple, which is what this is traditionally called, has two levels. On one level, this is a story about moving from a transactional faith to a passionate faith. I base that on this being the only version of this story, and there are four versions of this story, one in each gospel, but in John's version, it's the only one where Jesus does not call the temple a den of thieves. In the other gospels, he clears out the temple and he says, "Do not make God's house a den of thieves," implying that the problem he had with the people there that he just kicked out was that they were acting dishonestly. Maybe they were cheating people. Maybe they were gouging on their sale of sheep and cattle. The criticism is not about just doing business in the temple. It's about doing business dishonestly. But in John's gospel, as you heard, Jesus simply says, "Don't make God's house a place of business." In other words, our relationship with God should not be transactional. Finding peace with God cannot be attained by buying a cow or a sheep or a dove that will then be ritually sacrificed at the temple. Faith doesn't work that way. It should not be some kind of quid pro quo between us and God. "God, I will do these things. I will be honest and I will be a good person and I'll give generously. And in exchange, you, God, will give me things. You will make sure that I'm healthy or my family is protected or that I have wealth or that I will get into heaven." That's the transactional approach to faith. What do I have to do and what will I get out of it? Then we hear what John is inviting us to move toward. When John, as the narrator, quotes Psalm 69:9. This is the only gospel that this quote from this psalm is in this story. It says in verse 17, as the disciples watched Jesus zealously clearing out the temple, they quote, "Remembered that it was written, 'Passion for your house consumes me.'" So John is inviting us toward that passionate faith. What does it mean to have a passionate faith? Well, it's not much different than being madly in love with a person. When you are passionately in love with somebody, it's not transactional. You don't keep score of how much you've done in the relationship and how much the other person has done, or the way that you've failed and where the other person has failed. We save that for marriage. But when you first fall in love with someone, you're just all in. You have faith in that person, you trust the person, you don't keep score, you think they hung the moon, you want to give everything to the relationship, you don't worry if you look foolish to the world. So it is with our faith in God. We're invited to trust completely, to be all in, and to not worry what people think. So John is presenting us with a choice between it's an oversimplified choice for sure, but rhetorically, the question is, will you have a transactional faith or will you have a passionate faith? In this story, Jesus clearly chooses the side of a passionate faith, evidenced by his fervent, daring, audacious actions, not caring what people think, making a whip and driving people and animals from the temple. So that's one level of the cleansing of the temple, moving from transactional to passion. Another level is moving from a faith in institutions to a faith in community. The critique of institutions is plain as day. Jesus literally walks into the heart of the institution of the religion of his day, which also happens to be the political epicenter of his nation, and he just starts breaking stuff. This is an iconoclastic, anti-institutional Jesus. Now, the movement to community is not as plain, so let me break it down a little. When the religious leaders ask Jesus by what authority he's doing these things, he says, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." And just to make sure we don't miss the point, John comes in as the narrator and gives the reader an aside. The temple he was talking about was his body. And that's common in John. We get people who are talking about something literal while Jesus is talking about something spiritual, and they're missing each other, or the literal people don't get the spiritual point. So the religious leaders think that Jesus is talking about the building, the institution being destroyed, and in 3 days he's going to rebuild it, put the blocks all back on top of each other. But Jesus is not talking about that. He's talking about his own death and then his body being raised up. But remember what we talk about in this series several times already. John is almost always speaking symbolically. He's not writing a history book. He's writing a book to testify about his community's experience of divine love. He's writing a book to testify about what it was like when they came together around a common table and followed the teachings of Jesus to share everything in common. And John, the character of Jesus, in many ways is a symbol of that experience of love within community. Or to say it in traditional terms, they were experiencing the risen Christ among them. Now put all that together, and Jesus is saying, you can kill my body, but you can't kill my spirit. You can kill my body, but my love, my life, my soul will live on in those who follow my teachings, those who share generously with each other around a common table without restrictions or exceptions. But the story is told in that way where the religious leaders are talking about the institution while Jesus is talking about the spirit. So the message is, destroy the physical building of the temple, and the community is what will rise up. And historically, interestingly, that's exactly what happened. In 70 CE, about 20 years before John was writing, the Jerusalem temple was destroyed by the Romans. So John wasn't speaking hypothetically here. He was talking about his own experience, what he knew. The Jerusalem temple had been destroyed by the Romans, and the church continued to live and to thrive. And just to be fair, Judaism also continued to live and to thrive in the form of synagogues or local communities. So in some ways, this is not about exclusively Christian magic. It's what humans do when their institutions are torn down. They come up and come together in community. Rebecca Stolnit has written a book called A Paradise Built in Hell, The Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disasters. The book documents this process in detail. She tells the story of various disasters throughout history and how, contrary to reports that you might hear on the news of looting or crime, what's often happening on the ground is that people are pulling together. People are helping each other. There are remarkable demonstrations right after a disaster of selflessness and resourcefulness and generosity. As the institutions of the powerful fall and social hierarchies dissolve, new, more egalitarian communities take their place, sometimes only briefly, but sometimes there are efforts to sustain what has emerged, to sustain that egalitarian spirit. The first disaster that Stolnit describes is the Great San Francisco earthquake of 1906, which not only toppled many buildings, but resulted in massive fires throughout the city, and the fires probably destroyed more buildings than the earthquake. And she writes that community kitchens sprung up all over the city, encampments happened in Golden Gate Park and over in Oakland, and grocers just started giving away their stock. but people didn't take more than they needed. It was just this remarkable community spirit that emerged. It was a utopia built in hell. As buildings burned and rubble was all around, these communities emerged. In one chapter, she describes the experience of a little girl who was 8 and a half when the earthquake struck, and who wrote later about her experience. And that little girl was Dorothy Day, who went on to become a journalist, a social activist, and the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, which included radical egalitarian communities. So Stolnit makes the case that it was Day's experience of community after the earthquake that led to her to seek ways to sustain that experience of community throughout her life, through the church and through the Catholic Worker Movement. So this is Day's memory of the aftermath of the quake. What I remember most plainly about the earthquake was the human warmth and kindliness of everyone afterward. For days, refugees poured out of burning San Francisco and camped in Idora Park and the racetrack in Oakland. People came in their night clothes, there were newborn babies, and Mother, Day's mother, Mother and all our neighbors were busy from morning to night cooking hot meals. They gave away every extra garment they possessed. They stripped themselves to the bone in giving, forgetful of the morrow. While the crisis lasted, people loved each other. Now, since it's MLK weekend, I really wanted to end here with a quote from King about his concept of the beloved community. Our text is inviting us to move from transactional faith to passionate faith, from institutions to community, and it would seem that King's concept of the beloved community would be the perfect ending. But it turns out King did not ever say in depth exactly what he meant by that term. I mean, he would describe it, and it was infused throughout his writing and his work, and you could say that in his I Have a Dream speech, he was talking about it. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream that one day in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. That's the beloved community, but he never calls it that in the speech. And King even wrote a book called Where Do We Go From Here, From Chaos to Community, which could be the subtitle of our story this morning as well. But even in that book, King doesn't specifically say, this is what I mean by beloved community. So we'll have to rely on a scholar of King to summarize this concept. This is black historian, pastor, and activist, and a friend of King, Vincent Harding. For King, the beloved community was not an abstract ideal or a distant utopia, which, by the way, is what we might think listening to the I Have a Dream speech. But he goes on, it was the concrete goal toward which discipline struggle moved. It required confrontation, suffering, and deep transformation of social structures. Community was not possible without justice, and justice was not possible without a community strong enough to hold conflict without turning to domination. So as I watched the images on TV this week of Minneapolis, I fear the worst, I think as many of us do. I don't really know what even the worst is, but when you see those images and those videos, everything feels so chaotic and so completely out of control. But then I think about how communities emerge after disasters, and I think about King's beloved community that required confrontation and suffering and deep transformation of social structures. And I think of Jesus literally creating chaos in the temple that day, swinging around a whip, chasing people out, cows and sheep, turning over tables, coins scattering all over the place. And I think of his promise that this entire building could come crashing down, all the institutions in which we put so much of our faith, and that love manifest in community would rise up. And taking it all together, I remember that we are not, in fact, called to put our faith in institutions, not in the police, not in political parties, not in Republicans or Democrats. We are not called to put our faith in the US government or the stock market or capitalism or religion. We're called by Christ to put our faith in each other, in love manifest in community. And I remember John's calling that love should be passionate, fervent, audacious, never calculating or asking what we have to give or what we'll get in return, but instead to fall in love with each other and with the oppressed and with humanity itself and with the earth, to be intoxicated by love. So here's John's invitation. Don't have faith in the institutions of this world. Have faith in love, have faith in each other, and from chaos, create community. Amen.